It's Monday, April 26th, and you've been warned. But of what exactly? We start here. More than a week after halting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the CDC says everyone is good to go, with a caveat.
The question that I have is whether or not women are going to sign up for this.
If anyone in your life just got a shot or is still waiting on one, we will break down what you should know. After 100 years, the White House finally calls it a genocide. So what took so long?
The relationship between Turkey and the United States could not be any worse.
There's a lot more at stake here for President Biden than just vocabulary. And she's running.
It's a little bit unclear who she thinks her base is going to be.
Gavin Newsom is still in the California governor's mansion. So why is everyone trying to keep up with Caitlyn Jenner? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. It's a new week in this pandemic, and it's a whole new world for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Breaking news on the Johnson & Johnson one-shot vaccine here in the U.S. Late today, a CDC panel recommending lifting the pause and restarting vaccinations here in the U.S. with that vaccine.
More than 30 states are now taking steps to restart vaccinating people with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine this afternoon.
Going into last Friday, this potentially game-changing COVID vaccine was still being kept away from American arms. Well, after more than a week of waiting, a week of studying the super rare blood clots that have accompanied some injections, and a week of intense debate among scientists, this vaccine is back. But will people take it? Heck, as we see vaccination rates fall off, some scientists are wondering if Americans will even take both doses of the other vaccines. Let's go to ABC's Ann Flaherty to start us off. Ann, what do we have to know about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine as of this morning? Who can get it? Is it safe?
Well, everybody. And it's available widely across the country. And federal regulators are now saying that it's extraordinarily safe. The benefits outweigh the risks.
We're calling into session Friday, April 23rd, 2001, emergency meeting of the ACIP to discuss Janssen vaccine. And my knuckles will serve as the gavel.
Now, just to rewind a little bit back to last week, we did have this 10-day pause while federal regulators and an advisory panel were trying to figure out exactly what happened.
So the thrombocytopenia in association with these clotting events is unique.
You know, unfortunately, they just never came up with this aha moment to explain these 15 cases out of 8 million injections. It's almost a testament to the system to monitor the safety of vaccines that they even found these cases.
I would say that the depth of thrombocytopenia could suggest that the process has been going on, ongoing longer, or should have some, maybe reflects the titer of antibodies, the immune reaction that's been triggered. It could be either one of those things.
But there was enough of a pattern of these medical complications that they thought, yes, this probably is tied to the vaccine. But they just couldn't figure out in the end why.
It seems like it affects people that are younger in age and seems to affect women more than men so far. But I don't think we can just focus on oral contraceptive users or obese patients.
All of the cases were women. They were ranging in age from 18 into their early 50s. Most of the women were in their 30s, but they couldn't explain it.
To exclude them from vaccine, getting the J&J vaccine or the AstraZeneca vaccine, I don't think we can do that.
They couldn't say that there was one type of person or one type of risk factor that would increase your chances of this type of abnormal blood clot. And so they decided to move forward with a warning. There's going to be fact sheets that will go out to both healthcare providers and to patients to explain these complications. And I think the really important part of this, Brad, is that they say it's a treatable condition.
If you recognize it right away. And one of the reasons I think it's been good to have this pause is to get everybody apprised of that, so that all physicians know that this is something to watch out for.
And that's what we heard from the NIH director last Friday, who said, you know, if you catch this early enough and you know the symptoms, a very severe headache, this isn't just a headache and malaise, this is a severe headache 6 to 18 days after the injection, difficulty breathing, leg pain. Those are the things that you need to get into the emergency room. Do not try to treat those symptoms at home. And what we did see with these 15 cases is that many of the women did try to ride out their symptoms. And federal regulators are saying that is not a good idea.
But so then I'm confused. If they're basically saying, hey, everyone's good to take this, But all the cases we've seen are in women of a certain age range. Why wouldn't you just say, we're putting this back out, but only to men, or only to men and maybe women over the age of 50 years old or so? Like, why wouldn't you make it just a little bit more restricted if these are the cases?
Well, they talked about that, but in part, this is such a small number of cases, 15 out of 8 million. It could be tied to women, or that just could be by accident.
Right.
You know, one of the things that they have pointed out is that the AstraZeneca vaccine has seen blood clots as a reaction, and some of those cases were men. So they're not 100% confident that they know exactly what is going on.
When it's that few, it's hard to say there's any pattern at all.
Exactly.
My arm was sore right after they gave it to me, but that went away after about an hour. And so far, so good.
So we've heard that states have started right away. As of Saturday morning, they started to resume shots. You had millions of shots sitting on shelves just waiting to go.
Emily Murray from Detroit, one of the first in line.
You have to decide if the risk is worth it.
I'd be very concerned about my daughter. I would not want her to. I'd want her to hold off.
The question that I have is whether or not women are going to sign up for this. I think there are some really valid concerns that women have, particularly if they have Pfizer and Moderna vaccines as an option. Now, in some parts of the country, you won't have an option. And this is where the federal regulators are saying, really, you do not need to worry about this extraordinarily rare event. You probably are more likely to get COVID, and this could save your life.
Right. That's the bottom line, is like, you're still trying to protect. If you're really trying to protect your health, get a vaccine. This is the only vaccine where one shot will do you, right? And like the others, you need two to be considered vaccinated against COVID-19. Yet now we're seeing reports that people are not all getting their second doses. How big of a problem does that represent?
Well, that's right. The New York Times has unearthed some interesting data that about roughly 5 million people have missed their second dose of Moderna and Pfizer. Now, just to rewind it back a little bit, if you remember, the CDC has put out guidance to say, you know, if you're running a little bit behind, if you're a few days, don't worry about it. Just get your second shot. We can't tell you exactly when you'll stop being protected. You know, if you go too long between two shots, try to keep it as close to the recommended schedule as possible. They just don't know. They want you to get that second shot because that's what they know will protect you and fully immunize you.
46-year-old Zvi Ish-Shalom says after experiencing extended symptoms from the Moderna vaccine, he's holding off on getting the second shot, but stands by his decision to get the first.
If I were to get COVID, would I have regretted not getting the vaccine? And the answer was a resounding yes.
Now, obviously, the question is, why are people not getting their second shot? Are they afraid of symptoms? Are they having trouble getting to the vaccination clinic? I mean, I think those are the things that we're going to be asking, and the federal government will be trying to solve this riddle going forward.
Yeah, and there's been some speculation that, you know, people who get their first dose, there's side effects, headaches, you know, just kind of feeling like you have a flu all day. It's no fun. I mean, we have somebody actually on with us right now. David Rind, our producer, is listening in on this conversation. And David, you just got like the Pfizer vaccine, the second dose of Pfizer on Sunday, right?
Yeah, sure did.
Are you okay?
I'm all right. You know, I feel a little ache coming on, but I'm here. I'm working.
Yes.
So it's all good.
And I'm glad you're with it. David Rind, soldiering on. And Flaherty, great information as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, everyone said it would take one word to truly enrage our allies in Turkey, and Joe Biden just used it. That's after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
You've probably heard of the word genocide. Well, the word itself is not something that's been in the English language for centuries or anything. It's pretty new. In fact, it was created by this Polish man, Raphael Lemkin, who had studied this massacre of Armenian people back in 1915. And at the time, he's thinking, this is messed up. Like, it's weird that there's not a word for this. Then, all of a sudden, the Holocaust is happening. Lemkin has fled his native Poland. He's trying to convince American lawmakers to stop the atrocities from Nazi Germany. But again, he's realizing there's no word for this, the elimination of a people, of a culture. So he creates a word, genocide. We use it to describe what happened in Germany. People get held accountable. We've used it ever since. And yet, American leaders in Lemkin's adopted homeland, U.S. presidents, never actually agreed with him that the genesis for his obsession, this massacre in and around modern-day Turkey, was actually a genocide. A U.S. president really has not come out and said that. Well, this weekend, that all changed.
Just a few lines of a White House statement which could shake up the complex relationship between two crucial NATO members. Joe Biden has recognized the massacres of Armenians by Ottoman forces in 1915 as a genocide.
And if you think, well, I'm not Armenian, but it's not applied to me, this could have big implications around the world. So let's bring in ABC's Connor Finnegan. He covers the State Department and diplomacy. Connor, we saw an outpouring of emotion this weekend over this reclassification. Why?
Brad, this is such an emotional issue. And as you said, it goes back over a century.
1915, never again!
1915, never again!
Absolutely remarkable.
There were massive celebrations in cities around the world, especially, obviously, Armenia, but places like Los Angeles as well, where there's a huge Armenian-American community.
This is a new beginning for us. I feel it's a new beginning for my children.
Armenia, united! We'll never be divided!
And for them, this is a recognition that they have been seeking for decades.
What really hit me is that I grew up my whole life and my parents grew up our whole life really, really fighting for this moment. And that our daughter, Samantha, will never have to fight this fight.
It's such an emotional issue because this was the slaughter of 1.5 million people in what is modern day Turkey, at the time, the Ottoman Empire.
Sometimes, like from inside, I'm crying.
The Turks have considered this just part of the atrocities committed during World War I. It's part of the violence, they say, of this global conflict.
But thanks God that our president, he must have had some kind of guts between all those presidents that he gets up and he accepts the genocide.
But for Armenians, they were targeted because of their nationality, their religion. And the slaughter and deportation of so many people is obviously still a very raw issue for these communities, for these families.
And so, okay, it seems like a huge deal. Seems unequivocal that these slaughters, as you said, took place. So what took so long? Like, what's the problem with calling this what it was?
The problem for the longest time is that the U.S. does not want to upset its critical NATO ally, Turkey. Mm. The Turkish government, as I said, has long denied that this was a genocide. They say it doesn't meet the legal requirements that have been set out in international law. And because of that, they have strongly urged, you know, successive U.S. presidents not to make this kind of declaration. And the U.S. has acquiesced, essentially. They know that Turkey is so important for their projection of power throughout the region. You know, there are U.S. troops based at a Turkish air base in Incirlik, where there are, you know, nuclear weapons that belong to the U.S., where there are fighter jets that were critical to the fight against ISIS in neighboring Syria. And so for the longest time, American presidents knew that it was more important for them geopolitically to not upset Turkey than to really put human rights first. But that calculus has changed in recent years, honestly, because the relationship between Turkey and the United States could not be any worse.
Overseas tonight into Turkey, where there are major new developments after the attempted coup there. And tonight, the United States is now caught in the middle.
There's a long litany of issues and accusations between the two sides. Turkey believes that the U.S. is harboring the man responsible for a 2016 coup against President Erdogan.
God bless him. He's going to decide on whose side he's on. He's either on our side or he's on Russia's side.
The U.S. is upset that Turkey purchased a Russian missile defense system in violation of U.S. law. President Trump actually finally sanctioned Turkey over that in December after intense pressure from Congress.
We're just fighting terrorists, period. Because the terrorists don't have an ethnicity, they don't have a nationality, they don't have a flag.
The U.S. has been arming and training Kurdish forces across the border in Syria that Turkey considers terrorists. And I think after all these issues have continued to build up and up and up, the U.S. finally recognized that now is actually maybe the best moment in time to do this.
Okay, so, wow. And so if you're talking about, I mean, real military and geopolitical concerns here, like the U.S. having a foothold in the Middle East, especially if we're getting out of Afghanistan, like that's a big deal. What does this mean now for international relations if Turkey is even more upset with the U.S. than ever?
I think that's really the critical question at this point. Turkey has said, you know, there will be repercussions for this.
The statement by the U.S. president is very unfortunate, unfair. We completely reject it. It has no legal basis. And politically speaking, it's an irresponsible, unconstructive statement.
But I think at the end of the day, Turkey doesn't have a lot of options to turn to. There's a lot of concern that Turkey would move closer to President Putin and Russia. But at the same time, Turkey is fighting Russia, essentially, in shadow wars, in proxy right. conflicts in both Syria and in Libya. And at the end of the day, I think Erdogan knows that his strongest hand is to play all sides against each other as it tries to play a greater and greater role throughout the region.
Yeah, and if people try to tell you that words don't matter, that one word, the havoc that it is wreaking right now across the international community and the joy, like you said, it has sparked in Armenian communities around the world. All right, Connor Finnegan, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
We're going to talk about the Oscars in a bit, but before we do, it's worth remembering that every year there's this big question of how much politics belong in entertainment. But when you think about Hollywood and even California more broadly, that line has always been pretty blurry.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ronald Reagan.
Good evening. I'm here tonight to announce my intention to seek the Republican nomination for President of the United States.
Ronald Reagan became one of the most beloved Republican presidents in history after his acting career propelled him to the governorship.
I've heard your voices loud and clear.
The only California governor ever actually recalled and removed from office led to the governator.
For the people to win, politics as usual must lose.
Next tonight, the political headline this evening, Caitlyn Jenner is now running for governor of California.
Well, if you thought all that was bizarre, Caitlyn Jenner is now writing an even more improbable script. She announced on Friday she is running to replace the current Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom. But will anyone buy the script that she's shopping around? ABC's Liz Kreutz is an anchor with our affiliate KGO in San Francisco. She's a veteran of state and national politics. Liz, I mean, first of all, Gavin Newsom, he's not out necessarily, but should we take this decision from someone like Caitlyn Jenner to mean that a recall is looking more inevitable?
Yeah, so true, Brad. Gavin Newsom is still the governor, and he very likely could still be the governor even after this recall election.
She shocked the world when she came out as transgender in 2015. Caitlyn Jenner, now with a new stunning announcement. She
says, Caitlyn Jenner is just one of many people who want to throw their hat into the ring preemptively to say, hey, I'm ready to run. And that is because even though the recall has not officially qualified the recall election, it is pretty much inevitable at this point that it is going to qualify. Californians are going to go to the polls at some point this year and vote on a recall if we want to recall Gavin Newsom or not.
Governor Newsom has received significant pushback on a number of COVID-related issues that include stay-at-home orders, the state's slow rollout of coronavirus vaccines, reopening schools, billions in unemployment fraud, and of course that evening in November when the governor was seen dining out with friends after just telling Californians to avoid gatherings.
And so once this happens, once we get the official go, then a date will be set by the lieutenant governor and Californians will go to vote. And when they vote, they're going to see two things on their ballot. They're going to see, one, do you want to recall Governor Gavin Newsom? Yes or no? And then it will say, number two, if the recall passes, who would you want to be the next governor?
Am I worried about it? Of course I'm worried about it. The nature of these things, the up or down question, the zero sum nature of the question is challenging and it's vexing.
In 2003, there were 135 names on that ballot, of course, including Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Well, which leads us to Caitlyn Jenner, right? What's so interesting to me is, you know, you look at Caitlyn Jenner, she's perhaps the most famous transgender person on the planet, right? She's actually come across as quite politically conservative in the past. But does it get tough when, in a year when Republicans across the country have embraced a slate of anti-trans laws, she is running as a Republican?
Yeah, it's a bit mind-boggling, honestly, for a lot of people, both in California and I think a lot of people in the LGBTQ community. We saw Equality California on Friday, after she announced, come out with a statement that said, of course we want a transgender candidate. Of course we do. But Caitlyn Jenner, hard pass. Another friend of mine who is trans and she's on the San Francisco Pride board, she wrote to me, "We are horrified."
Defending Caitlyn Jenner and educating the public on this vanity campaign is less energy, less time, less resources that we can spend protecting trans children across the country who are under attack right now.
So it's a little bit unclear who she thinks her base is going to be, assuming she is doing this not just for publicity, but she's doing it because she really wants to be the governor of California. You know, you don't really see Republicans at the state of the current Republican Party getting behind her. But, you know,
right, like the people who would most want Gavin Newsom out of office. You're wondering if those are the same voters that would be like, yes, I'm definitely voting for a trans woman. Like, that's my governor.
Exactly. I can tell you from some of the voters that I've met, maybe some of them would, but I just don't really see Caitlyn Jenner being their go-to candidate.
You're a member of Congress from California. It looks like a recall is going to happen on Governor Newsom.
But it does sort of put even Democrats in a tricky situation.
You think her candidacy is real or a stunt?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Whatever it is, though, you know, she is getting a lot of publicity. Maybe that's helpful, but it's certainly not helpful to the state of California.
People are just sort of waiting right now to see how serious she really is and if her candidacy really even takes off.
Initially supporting Donald Trump when he ran for president, she stopped backing him after his administration repeatedly attacked transgender rights in 2018. She spoke to Variety that year.
On the economic side, I'm very conservative. I believe in limited government. I believe in lower taxes. I believe in less regulations. I want a thriving economy. I want Americans to be able to succeed.
I think it's easy to make comparisons between Arnold Schwarzenegger and Caitlyn Jenner. You know, we had this celebrity candidate back in 2003. We had this celebrity candidate now. But there's a lot of differences both between them in terms of their policy and also in terms of California. I mean, California is a much different state than it was in 2003. It's much more Democratic.
She hasn't voted frequently. She hasn't weighed in on a number of questions. And it really is a novelty. And it speaks in some ways to the danger of recall politics.
The Republican Party isn't even the second largest party. The second largest party after Democrat in California is no party preference. So the Republicans are going to have a really hard time winning this race just given the breakdown of the state.
All right. Liz Kreutz there at KGO in San Francisco. Thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you, Brad.
Now, I promised you an Oscar wrap-up, and if you thought Glenn Close doing Da Butt was the weirdest moment of the evening, you went to bed too early. One Last Thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, Regina King.
And one last thing. A big part of filmmaking is transporting your audience. Well, award show directing is no different.
Think of this as a movie set.
And when we look back at the 93rd Academy Awards, last night's broadcast will be remembered for the way it was presented in the COVID era. Not in a big grand theater, but in a train station. No big crowd, just steady cams taking you from little table to little table.
I've got a question for all the nominees here. Can I get a quick show of hands? How many of you?
No host, just a rotating set of cast members handing out a few awards at a time. Some of these wins were historic.
Chloe Zhao, Nomadland, Canada.
Chloe Zhao became the first woman of color and just the second woman at all to win Best Director.
We want to show our deepest gratitude to Linda May, Swan Key, Bob Wells, and Nomadic Community, all the people we met on the road.
Her film Nomadland won Best Picture. Well, that's where things got bizarre. Because Best Picture was not the final award of the night.
I'm here to present the Oscar for Best Actress.
Instead, in a surprise move, the producers arranged to have it followed by Best Actress, which for the second time in the last few years went to Frances McDormand.
We know the sword
is our work, and I like work. Thank you for knowing that, and thanks for this.
And then, Best Actor. But if you start thinking like a TV producer, you go, oh, okay, I get what they're going for here. Chadwick Boseman is the odds-on favorite to win Best Actor. That would create this really poignant moment at the end of the show where he wins posthumously. Like, what a way to end that broadcast.
I'm supposed to talk about acting.
But instead, Joaquin Phoenix quickly marches out and announces,
Anthony Hopkins, the father. The Academy congratulates Anthony Hopkins and accepts the Oscar on his behalf.
It's Anthony Hopkins, who isn't even attending the show and has no one there to accept this award on his behalf. So,
hey, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight at the 93rd Oscars.
The 93rd Academy Award just abruptly end. And really, the most unique thing about this entire evening was how quiet it was. For 3 hours, there were barely any clips shown of the movies being awarded. Even the nominees for Best Score were announced in silence. It felt like you were sitting in the middle of a really intimate office awards night with some work colleagues, which is cool and special, but can also be jarring if the people aren't your colleagues.
That's not fair to Glenn Close. She don't know nothing about
doing it. Wait a second. I know. That's the butt.
Like when Name That Song resulted in Glenn Close naming and then dancing to Da Butt. Or when Daniel Kaluuya ended a long speech thanking his original executive producers, his parents.
We're breathing, we're walking, it's incredible. Like, it's incredible. My mom met my dad, they had sex. It's amazing. Like, do you understand? I'm here.
And yes, dear old mom was watching live. I mean, my favorite speech was Yeo Jung-yoon becoming the first Asian woman in 50 years to win Best Supporting Actress, and then being like, hey, I'm going to use this time to mack on Brad Pitt. Like, I appreciate a game plan. Start here tomorrow. Hit subscribe if you haven't already. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.